For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So we started out chapter 3 with this verse last week. Whoever desires to be an overseer or an elder, this is the top position of leadership in the New Testament pattern of church leadership, also in this church as well, led by a group of elders. They desire a noble task. And, you know, we considered this question here, is it arrogant to want to be a spiritual leader? And as I argued last week, that properly understood, it's actually arrogant to not want to be a spiritual leader. To say, God, no, you can't use somebody like me. To say, God, no, I've got my own plans. I want to work to build my kingdom instead of yours. You know, that's a misunderstanding of the goodness of God and the love of God and the nature of reality. And so we saw that Paul goes into a list of qualities. He's writing to his protege, Timothy, who is there at this church of Ephesus, acting on Paul's behalf, sent there into a situation fraught with false teachers. He's sent there to bring order. And he says the key to victory in this church and the key to victory in any spiritual work, I'm convinced, is training, finding, and releasing godly leaders to serve God in the midst of a community. And so he says this overseer needs to be above reproach, sexually self-controlled, mentally sharp, stable, and live a well-ordered life. We saw the first five of these qualities last week. And he goes on to list a whole lot more qualities for these elders and also another leadership position called deacons. We've got a lot to cover, so let's go ahead and get into this. You know, this vision here of mature Christian character, we've got to understand, it is not a list of rules. It's not a list of laws that I'm supposed to follow. No, instead, it's something God has committed to building in you. And it's hard to keep that in mind as we talk about these things, as we suggest practical steps, as we paint the vision for what it's supposed to look like. It's easy to feel bad. It's easy to think that this is something I must do. But we've got to remember, the whole Christian life begins, unlike every other religion, it begins with something that God does for us. As it says in Ephesians 2:8, it is by grace that you've been saved through faith. It's a gift of God. It's not a result of your own works. It's not that you get your life together and then you become a Christian. No, it's your life is not good enough for God. Do not meet his standard of perfection. And so that's why Jesus Christ came. That's why he died. He offers forgiveness to anybody who's willing to receive that forgiveness. That's the starting point. And then a lot of people think, okay, now that I've been forgiven, now it's time for me to get to work in this self-improvement project. But as we saw in the last book that we studied, Colossians, Paul says, therefore, as you have received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk in him. The way you become a Christian, by grasping the grace, the generosity, the goodness, the forgiveness of God, and by placing your trust in him, that's also how you grow. You grow in your relationship with God. You grow in your trust for him. You grow in your understanding of how he sees you, how he sees the world. You take steps of faith based on those truths, and that's how growth works. And so we've got to keep that in mind as we look here at this list of this vision for what God wants to do in mature Christians. And it's a cool vision for leadership. So, the overseer is to be... We're just going to knock out all the rest of these in this chapter. First of all, hospitable. And you know, this word is xenos. Philo or philo, which means loving. And xenos, which means stranger or foreigner. And so this is somebody that loves xenos. In the Greek sense of that word. The lover of strangers, loving of the foreigner, lover of the outsider. You know, this is showing love not for the people that are in my little clan, my little friend group, people that are like me, but someone that has an outward orientation and shows love for people that are different than me, maybe people who I don't even know. This is going to include opening up your home to other people. You know, that's kind of wrapped up in the modern notion of hospitality. But this word is much deeper than that. But, you know, it would include generosity. It would include willingness to invite people into your home. I don't know if you've been in homes before where you just felt like afraid to touch anything. because it just had that uptight feel to it. I love the fact that sometimes people in my home church, I've overheard them accidentally call my house their home, which is pretty cool. You know, they show up at my house, and I love the fact that they just open the fridge and they just start going through it. Although I have learned to hide my choice leftovers. Because if hiding my Chipotle is wrong, I don't want to be right, okay? And you can have my resignation as an elder. But the fact that, you know, to extend hospitality, to extend home to people, I think that is awesome, and we should be known for that. But it's more than that. You know, this includes genuine interest in new people. You know, not tribal or provincial, as we've got this drive in all of us to build up our own little kingdom, our own little fiefdom, our own little safe world. And what God says is, no, that's not good enough just to love people that are like you. You need to go out of that. You know, this includes the notion of being a good listener. It's taking interest in people, listening to their lives, and remembering that and asking them about that, showing love and interest. It loves those who society rejects. Yes, the Christian community, the body of Christ, should be a place that loves people that don't get a hearing in the rest of society. People who the world doesn't have time for, doesn't have any use for. This should be a safe place for people like that. That was one of the things that really stood out about Christ, is he loved the people. He loved the dimly burning candle, the reed that was bent over. And it says he will not even break a bent reed. Jesus even says you need to love your enemies. And he says, even the most ungodly people you can think of, even they love those that love them. You know, why don't you love your enemies? Why don't you be different? Why don't you show that you've got the love of God inside of you and that love is overflowing? Remember, these are qualities that show an inward reality, an inward spiritual reality. And so this is one of the characteristics that Timothy should be looking for in these leaders that he's selecting. It also says the elder must be able to teach. Able to teach. And, you know, this one here, skilled at teaching might be a little bit of a better translation. It doesn't say gifted at teaching. There is a place for elders that are gifted at teaching. He mentioned that later in 1 Timothy, but that's not a requirement. In fact, if you look closely at this list, you will notice there's not a single spiritual gift requirement for eldership. These are character qualities. These are things that can be learned. These are things that God cultivates in us. So the notion that, well, I'm just not gifted in that way, and so therefore God can't use me as a leader or even as an elder, not true. Not according to this list right here. That there's not a gifting requirement. Ability to teach, yeah, that's going to be important. You know, these, like it says in Titus 1:9, a very similar list for elders, he says, then he'll be able to encourage others with wholesome teaching and show those who oppose it where they are wrong. Yeah, good teaching is going to encourage people, build people up. But also there were these false teachers, remember? These elders, these leaders that Timothy is appointing need to be able to refute that false teaching. They're going to have to be able to discern error and heresy and to make a compelling presentation for the truth and why those guys are wrong. Even to convince the false teachers, Paul charges Timothy with in some cases. And so, you know, a few questions on this one. Are you teachable? You want to get good at teaching others. Are you teachable yourself? There's a lot that you're going to have to learn, and hopefully you're always going to have a learning posture. Always trying to be, and never feeling like I basically know everything at this point. Are you striving to deepen in your knowledge of God's Word? You know, are you in there on a daily basis in the Word of God? Are you reading challenging material? We'll talk some more about this when we get to 1 Timothy chapter 4, how to discipline ourselves for godliness. It'll be an interesting study over the next 2 weeks. Are you striving to improve in your teaching ability? Yeah. I recently read through a great book on how to teach the Word, and I felt like I was so challenged by that. There were things I had forgotten. There were new insights I feel like God gave me. Are we reading books on how to teach? I think it's a really good idea every time you teach to save that in a electronic format and to have that backed up online. Because then what you'll find is you go to teach a passage and you realize I've already taught this passage before, and that's your starting point, and then you can improve on the previous teaching. There's a lot of times where I'm teaching this passage and I'm like, I had some pretty good stuff over here in this other book on a similar topic, and I'm going and I'm digging stuff up. I was doing that for that this teaching here tonight, digging some stuff out of other teachings that I'd done and then building on that. And get it backed up online. Get all of your studies in the Word backed up. Google Drive will give you 30 gigs, okay, if you're a student. And I think it'll still give you 10 or 15 if you're not. So get it online. Get it backed up. I've talked to so many people that lost all of their notes from every Bible class they've ever taken. People have lost all of their Bible studies, all of their notebooks. What you'll find is that as the years go by, you'll start to have an accumulation of hundreds of teachings and also hundreds of different studies and different books of the Bible that you'll be able to draw from. I think another thing you hear from good teachers is when you think of a good illustration, write it down and file it away somewhere. I thought about this for years. I never did it. But with today's electronic cloud storage features, this is easier than it's ever been. I use this program called Evernote. Okay, I don't know if any of you have used it, but they've got a great little, they've got a web clipper, plugs right into Chrome. You see a good article and you're like, wow, that's an interesting article about, the effects of cohabitation on marital success. And all you do, you just click on it, it files it away, you can go in, you can tag it with whatever you want to tag it with, and then when you're teaching a topic, you click on that topic and, three things you thought of a year ago and two web articles that you read pop up, and there's you're getting started. So we got to be working hard to try to improve in our teaching ability. Do you communicate in a way that's offensive or argumentative, or are you easy to listen to? One of Timothy's challenges was these guys wanted to get into fights, and you're going to have to be able to teach in a way that you don't get sucked into stupid arguments. I've certainly got sucked into those before. Email exchanges, blog posting, just going back and forth with somebody that's angry. So, we're going to have to learn how to teach in such a way that it diffuses situations and even might persuade angry people to put their guns down and reconsider another point of view. Are you looking for opportunities to practice? When I was looking to learn how to teach, I was trying to take any possible opportunity that I could to teach the Bible. And honestly, where being a good teacher starts is, after meetings like this, after home church meetings, you're raising your hand, you're sharing a point. That's basically like a 30-second teaching, a one-minute communication of an idea. One-on-one conversations with people, trying to share what you've learned, trying to explain concepts, any chance you get to teach, I'd say go for it if you can swing it. So an elder needs to be able to teach, and they're going to need to discern heresy. I think our classes that we offer are really good for that. We try to show you guys alternate positions. We try to have meaningful dialogue about problems with that position and hold it up to the Word. But these false teachers in Timothy's church here, they were smooth talkers. And Christians have a hard time discerning false teachings. A lot of the heresies you see nowadays, they've been the same heresies in different forms for about 2,000 years now. And so studying the history of theology and doctrine, learning common features of false teaching, that's all real helpful if you're going to be somebody that's able to teach. Truth is real important when it comes to spiritual growth and the health of a spiritual community. And so we're going to need people that can dish that out in ways that is easy to understand and appealing for people. The overseer is also to be not given to drunkenness. Also deacons, it says that as well in 3:8. A lot of people are surprised that the Bible has a lot of positive things to say about alcohol. I don't know if you're aware of this. I was never aware of this. I grew up in a tradition where a lot of people just were like, a good Christian would never drink alcohol. And Psalms 104 says God makes grass grow for the cattle and plants for man to cultivate, bringing forth food from the earth and wine that gladdens the heart of man. Well, that seems like a pretty positive take on wine there. I know some Christians are like, well, wine in biblical times It was really just grape juice that had no alcoholic content. Which I don't know how that's possible considering it starts to ferment pretty quickly. I mean, they didn't have refrigeration back then. Or they'd be like, well, they would take it and they would dilute it to a strength of like one part wine to like 20 parts water or something like that. I just don't think that stands up to what I've read on this. You know, think about a verse like Song of Solomon 1:2. Oh, how I wish you would kiss me passionately, she says, for your lovemaking is more delightful than wine. Okay, so, you know, it's like she's comparing sex to the way wine makes you feel. Okay, I mean, imagine like, ooh, baby, making love to you is better than a big tall glass of grape juice. It's better than water that's got 1/20 wine mixed into it. Now there's a good feeling that comes from it. And scripture's cool with that. I mean, Jesus, his first miracle in John 2, they run out of wine, and what does Jesus do? He miraculously produces a 28 kegger. Do you realize if you do the math, it's 28 kegs and a pony keg is what Jesus produces of wine at that wedding. Good night. That seems like a little bit over the top. The Last Supper, he commands. He says, drink this cup of wine when you get together and remember me. Drink to me, Jesus says. When Christ comes back, it says in Isaiah 25, there's going to be this banquet. And it's going to have the finest meats and the finest aged wine. No, I mean, Scripture sees wine as something good to be enjoyed within its proper context. Of course, assuming that you're 21 years old, I'm sure I don't need to say that in this room. But at the same time, Scripture has only negative things to say about drunkenness. Nothing good to say about drunkenness. Proverbs 23, who has anguish? Who has sorrow? Who is always fighting? Who is always complaining? Who has unnecessary bruises? I like that phrase. Who has bloodshot eyes? It's the one who spends long hours in the taverns trying out new drinks. Yes. You know, who's always fighting, always complaining? Drunkenness will have this effect. I mean, unnecessary bruises, partly from the fighting, partly from running into stuff. The bloodshot eyes, the inability to sleep. Don't gaze at the wine, seeing how red it is, how it sparkles in the cup, how smoothly it goes down. Don't be intoxicated with this. He says, for in the end, it bites like a poisonous snake and it stings like a viper. Yes, that will be the long-term effect of drunkenness. You'll lose everything, and I've seen people have that happen to them. You'll see hallucinations. You will say crazy things. One of the problems with drunkenness is, as a Christian, we're supposed to be alert. We're supposed to be, you know, we're in a spiritual battle here. We're supposed to be on guard and watching for opportunities. And if we're drunk, we're going to say things that are so discrediting. You're going to say things you regret the next day. You're going to do things that you regret the next day. And you're basically going to tarnish your reputation and your witness with people and your leadership influence. You'll stagger like a sailor tossed at sea, clinging to a swaying mast. Yeah. And you will say, they hit me, but I didn't feel it. I didn't even know it when they beat me up. When can I wake up so I can look for another drink? That's the end of alcohol. That's the end of drunkenness right there. Making a fool of yourself, ruining your relationships, life is passing you by. And you're saying and doing things you would never do in your right mind. And yet, there's this drive for escape that comes with this. You know, this principle would apply to other drugs as well, like marijuana. Let's talk about that a little bit. I know there's a lot of talk about legalization of marijuana. A lot of people are like, well, you know, having a drink or two, smoking a joint, that's basically the same thing. I've talked to Christians that are like, yeah, I mean, if it was legalized, I would smoke up now and then. Well, you know, there are big differences here. You know, when it comes to marijuana, it stays in your body a lot longer. You know, THC dissolves in the fatty cell membranes and persists. Yeah, it's fat soluble, so your body can store it. THC is the main hallucinogen in marijuana. 50% of the THC is still there after a week and 10% a month later. Traces are still detectable in hair and urine for weeks after that. Yeah, I mean, basically what that says is a joint a month will effectively ensure that the THC never leaves your body, never leaves your brain. You know, it's not like alcohol where you can have a drink and still be cool. You basically go straight to stoned when it comes to smoking weed. You know, the effects are a lot worse than casual use of alcohol. You know, the NIH says a number of studies have linked chronic marijuana use and mental illness. Associations have also been found between marijuana use and other mental health problems, such as depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts among adolescents, personality disturbances, and lack of motivation to engage in typically rewarding activities. That's a big surprise right there. And so, what we've got to think about when it comes to this issue is that dependence on drugs and alcohol points to a deeper problem. Why do you need to inject a chemical into your body in order to deal with life? That's really the question. Why is not just, you know, dealing with life in a sober state, why can't you do that? There's a deeper issue there that you're running from. And every time you go, every time you hit the bottle, every time you go for this escape, your problems just get worse, your addiction just gets worse. Ephesians 5:18 says, do not be drunk on wine, but be filled with the Spirit. It's a different kind of spirit, if you will. Kind of a play on words there, but you know, there is joy and peace that comes from the fruits of the Spirit, from the fruits of walking with God and of spiritual growth and of healthy living, loving other people, loving God. There's joy that comes from that, peace that comes from that. And it's a healthy kind of high, if you will. And so we got to think about, is there a deeper problem here that I'm running from? Do you drink every day? Do you have to have it at every social interaction? Why is that? Maybe, it's hard to admit you have a problem in any area. This seems like an area it's harder for most people than a lot of other areas. And finally, do you have trouble in social settings when there's no alcohol? You know, is it because I really can't interact with people if I don't have several drinks? And if so, maybe there's a path to spiritual growth where you don't need that anymore in order to be around people. And God wants to do that for you. And for Timothy, you know, Paul's not anti-drinking. He even tells Timothy to have a drink later in this book. But he says, we can't be appointing leaders that are known to be drunkards, that are going around getting drunk. The overseer is to be not violent, but gentle, and not quarrelsome. So three different words, not violent, literally not a bully, whether physically or verbally, throwing their weight around. Gentle, this one's interesting. Colin Brown's lexicon says, this is in contrast to the attitude which demands that rights, including one's own, should be upheld at all costs. Yes, so it's an insistence on my rights. It's a clinging to the letter of the law, clinging to all of my rights, exacting perfect justice without any room for empathy or compassion or human weakness. Peaceable literally means not a fighter, a machos, not macho. You know, there's kind of this machismo, this macho ideal of that toughness is the ultimate. And, you know, not feeling, people are scared of me, that's like cool or something. He says, no, not in spiritual leaders. Also, later on in the same passage, he says for deacons, they need to be not slanderers or not malicious gossips, not people that go around attacking with their words behind people's backs. You know, so that's a passive-aggressive way to express anger, is to cut people down when they're not around, to spread lies, to spread, even just to tell stories of bad things that the person did. Not good for spiritual leaders. In other words, godly leaders have their anger under control. Godly leaders have their anger under control. That's really the picture that's being painted here. And so what it means, it's the difference between being slow to anger versus having a short fuse. Do you go off real quick? Or, you know, is it the kind of thing where you can get it under control? It's not that you never get angry, but it's under control. It's anger in the right place at the right time and doing exactly what you want to do in that anger. Not losing control. Really under control versus violent outbursts. How angry do you get? Some of us are exploding on people. And that's a way to make people scared of you. It's not a way to gain respect as a godly man or woman. It's not God's way. It's not the way Christ was. Do you drop offenses or hold on to them? This is the slow burn of bitterness. This is anger prolonged. We remember the offense. We punish the person. We tear them down in our minds. We relive what they did to me. We root for their failure. We cheer when things go wrong for them. We're kind of sad when things go right for that person. Bitterness. Not God's way. He says, forgive as Christ forgave you. Not looking to pick fights or always correcting people. I had no idea how annoying this was. I would do this all the time. Correcting people, oh, you got your facts wrong on that. Or no, it's actually this way. Or no, the capital of Uzbekistan is actually blah, blah, blah. Some of us, for me, it was a lot of insecurity, wanting to be right. We need to show, it's like I want to show that I'm somebody. And, picking fights, it's a way to alienate people. Kind and empathetic and patient is the picture versus rigorous, legalistic, hard to please. Yeah, a godly person should be pretty easy to please, should be pretty flexible. And it's really the opposite of that machismo. You know, it's where we consider other people's feelings. I consider, how am I coming off here? Compassion is viewed as a strength, not a weakness. I think I used to kind of feel like that, like compassion is a weakness and like people just need to toughen up or something like that. It was just selfishness on my part. I didn't really want to think about how I was coming off. And, I was angry. And so God will have to take us to task on our anger. He's going to have to soften this part of our lives and make us into gentle, patient, empathetic, compassionate people who are slow to anger, who have our anger under control, and who forgive others. What are a few practical steps on this? One that's pretty helpful is you need to learn your warning signs. You need to be able to sense when you're about to lose your temper. When you're about to go off, and you need to get things under control before that point. I was pretty fortunate in my marriage because, you know, before I got married, I didn't even know I had an anger problem, all right? And then I got married. And I found myself getting so mad. You know, I've got this big picture window in my front room, and there were times where I would be in a conflict with my wife, and I would just feel this desire to, like, I just wanted to take something and throw it through that window. It was so big, and the glass, just to hear that glass shattering. And fortunately, my wife is a withdrawer, and so it kept things from escalating even more than they should, but I kind of had to learn how to walk away in that situation. I've told people, look, you just need to take a walk when you're feeling like that, and tell the person, I care about you. I want to work this out, but I got to get out of here right now. I'll be back and we'll talk later. But you got to learn your warning signs, and you got to learn how to step back before the explosion and not after. Find healthy ways to deal with stress. A lot of our anger is we've got this pent-up stress and we haven't found a way to unload this in healthy outlets like exercise, like rest, vacation, talk to people that never take vacations, they never rest, they feel guilty taking even an afternoon off from doing something. Hobbies, I think, can be really good for this. And after your blow-ups or your shutdowns, if you're more of a passive person and you shut down and give the cold treatment or whatever, I think it's good to apologize and analyze what happened. What took me down that path? What was really going on? I think maybe, you know, journaling about what I did and how I was feeling and what led there. I think that can be helpful in some cases. But it's learning to understand our anger, and you can kind of understand the triggers and the paths that lead you down that direction, too. Like with all these, spiritual growth will help a lot in this area, too. Free from the love of money. Free from the love of money, yeah. The elders managed the money in the early church. He says this for deacons, too. But the elders manage the money. And so an elder needs to be the kind of person that people are not viewing with suspicion. Somebody who's trustworthy with potentially a lot of money. And is not going to just be pocketing some. Is not going to be, you know, I'm behind on my bills, so I'm going to sneak some money. I've heard about people sneaking money out of their ministry house account to pay their own bills or floating themselves on rent, not telling anybody. Borrowing money without telling anyone. You know, when you're handling money, you've got to have trustworthy people on there. This is also, you need some accountability in there as well. You need more than one person with their eyes on this money. That's going to help too. That was also one of the patterns in the early church and also the practice we follow in this church. But the elders manage the money. They set the spending priorities. The false teachers, on the other hand, were in it for the money. Paul says they think godliness is a means of financial gain. And so, you know, that is the primary motive for false teachers then and now. It's dollars and cents. It's money. And so they needed to appoint people that were not driven by money. Were not always, their financial life is a mess because they're overspending and they want more and more and more and more and more, never happy with what they've got. And so just a few practical steps. We've actually got a whole chapter on this in 1 Timothy 6. So I'm not going to say as much about it tonight. But a few practical steps. One, learn to live simply and be content with what you have. It's one of Paul's main pieces of advice. Simple living, learning to appreciate. We live in a country that's so wealthy, if we can't appreciate the stuff and the perks that we have, we can't appreciate anything. Two, don't be so uptight about your stuff. You know, some people are so uptight about their stuff and worried about people breaking it and worried about what's going to happen to it. You know, maybe if you didn't have as nice of stuff, you wouldn't be so worried about it. I mean, I got this car. It can't be worth $1,000 at this point. And I don't care what happens to that thing. A friend of mine was backing up her car, boom, backed right in the door. I'm like, ah, whatever. Why don't you come over and cook us dinner, you know? We'll call it even. And it's an awesome car. But, you know, not being so tight about our stuff, maybe having stuff that's not quite as nice. My wife and I always talk about how grateful we are that even when we get something new, God manages to find a way to kind of mess it up a little bit so it leaves its pristine condition. So everything in my house and everything I own is just like a little bit off, you know? It's good though, because you know once you break the seal, then it's okay. And if other stuff happens to it as well, it's not the end of the world. Also, give sacrificially. I think that's a really good move. You know, start where you can. You know, don't give more than you're able. Though God might lead you into that at times, but giving sacrificially and trying to push the bounds of generosity. And if you do it little by little, you know, 0.5% or a percentage point a year even. Of what you make, you know, that's that adds up over time as you go on in your life. He also says that he must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him, and he must do so in a manner worthy of full respect. If anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? Yeah, that's a good point. If you can't even lead your family, how are you going to lead other people's families? How are you going to lead them into leading their families? Yeah, we've got to have, you know, so there's really two things here. Managing his own family and worthy of full respect. And it links these together here. And really the word manage, it's pretty weak. It's actually lead his own family. He must lead his own family. So it's a leadership question. How well does this person do leading the people who live with them? Leading the people who are closest to them? It's setting a spiritual tone in the house. That's what he's calling on here. Can you set a spiritual tone with the people that see every part of your life? So for parents, it means being able to gain, not demand, obedience from their kids. Yes, it's actually winning a following from your family. You, you start to see this pretty early on, whether parents can basically lead their kids. And, you know, are their kids just selfish brats that throw tantrums? And it's obvious that the reason they throw tantrums is because that works. Or are the parents able to get their kids under control when they're little and also to develop a relationship with them and continue to influence them as the kids get older? Some people wonder about this question. What if an elder's kid walks away from God? Does that mean the elder is not qualified to be an elder? Well, if it was like a younger kid, then that probably would be pretty disqualifying. You know, if you're 12 or 13-year-old, like giving God the finger and not, you know, even at that age, the parents should still have a pretty good amount of influence in their life. But, you know, once the kids are grown-ups, once the kids are in the late teens, 20s, the parent really doesn't have as much influence over them anymore. Although, you know, if my kids walked away even when they were older, I would probably do what some of the other elders in our church have done, which is go to my fellow elders and say, look, here's where my kid's at spiritually. I want your guys' honest opinion. Do you feel like I did everything I could in this situation? And if not, then maybe I need to step down from my position, or maybe I'm disqualified as an elder. And elders in our church have done that before, and basically submitted to the judgment of the other elders. And so it's not saying that their kid has to follow God for the rest of their lives, though it's pretty nice to see. But it's more of a leading the family while you still have the opportunity to do so. For married couples, it means you can get along with your spouse and serve God together. You see some people where the one spouse looks pretty spiritual, and then they get married, and then it's like their spouse just does not seem to be interested in spiritual things. And they can't get the person on board either. Or it's just a married couple that just can never seem to get along. They can't serve God together. You know, when you're fighting with your spouse, it's hard to think about anything else. I've been there. You know, 90% of my emotional energy is going into resolving this conflict before I can finally turn out and have a secure base to serve in the rest of my life. Singles, the way this would be evaluated for singles would be singles need to have healthy relationships with roommates. Yeah, you know, your roommates will find you out. You see some people that they seem to have good relationships, all these friends and all these other groups, but they can't get along with the people that they live with. And that's because that will expose you. You cannot hide from the people who you're closest to. You know, and we've got to be able to navigate these two extremes, passivity and power leadership. You see people swing back and forth between these two. On the one hand, let's say the husband is just passive, doesn't say anything, doesn't do anything, and then comes in with boom, with kind of a beat down on his wife or on his kids. And it's neither of those. It's relational influence. It's gaining a following from your family and leading in the right direction. We want people that can do that with those that are closest to them so that they can then do that with people who are a little bit further away from them. You know, Christians have been really guilty of this, of neglecting their family for the sake of their ministry. You can read stories about this. Driscoll goes through some examples in his book, Real Marriage. But he just goes through Christian after Christian who sacrificed his family on the altar of ministry. And this is not God's way, according to this right here. Practical steps we can take. For one, singles need to learn healthy relational skills now. Now is the time to start learning this, not once you're married. You know, are you emotionally disengaged? Guys, how are you gonna lead spiritually in your marriage if you can't emotionally engage with your wife? It's gonna drive her crazy. She's not gonna be able to listen to anything else you say. Anxiety and control, you see this one for both genders, maybe a little more from women. You're gonna go crazy, you're gonna try to control your husband and your kids, and nothing's ever gonna be enough. It's time to work on that. It's time to let God into that part of our lives and start trying to trust him a little bit more in that area. There's readings you can do on all of these. Unable to discipline in love. How are you going to discipline your kids in love if you cannot speak a hard word to a friend right now? If you can't speak the truth in love to people, then you're going to be terrified and just falling over yourself to give your kids whatever they want. And that is the last thing that they need, and it's not what they want either. They want boundaries. They want guidance. They want discipline. And so we can learn some of these things now, for sure. We can work on this now. Marrying well, that's a pretty good idea. For those of us that are not married, try to marry somebody spiritual. If you can, try to do what I did and marry up. Somebody's more spiritual than you. Try to draft off of them, you know. Invest in your family when you get to that point. I feel sad to see Christian parents not investing in the marriage, not investing in the kids. There's no time for a date night. There's no time. I think you should only have as many kids as you have time to hang out with one-on-one every week, whatever that is. And I just view my kids as two more disciples in my life. And really the most valuable ones that I've got. You know, what the truth is that 20 or 30 years from now, when you're looking back, there's a good chance you won't even be able to remember the names of most of the kids and most of the other people in your home church. And yet your kids, they're still going to be with you at that point, or they're not. And your investment in them, trying to teach them the things of God, that is so worth it. The overseer must not be a recent convert, or he may become conceited and fall into the same judgment as the devil. Not a new convert, not newly planted, literally, is what it says. There's a similar standard for deacons, but the standard is lower. It says in 3:10, they must be tested first, and then if they're above reproach, they can serve as a deacon. But with an elder, there's a certain time requirement here. Not a new believer. You know, for one, you need to see that they can handle success without getting proud. That's the warning here, right? Conceited, just like the devil did. You know, that was Satan's problem. He was awesome, and he had the top position of leadership. That was the worst thing that ever happened to him. And it says that he started to wonder, why is everybody following God? Why don't they follow me? And that's a danger in Christian leadership, and that's especially something that we're prone to if we've had a lot of success. I've seen leaders who've had a lot of success get proud, refuse to listen to advice, and undo a lot of the good that they've done, and maybe undo it altogether. It's scary. And so we need to see people can be successful and not proud, not self-willed and unwilling to listen to people because I know how to do this. I've been doing this for several months now. Look at my success. Why don't you listen to me? Three easy steps to ministry success. Yeah, right. Seeing them go through failure and suffering is actually pretty helpful too. You want to see, can they handle failure? Can they suffer? Can they stand fire under even those intense conditions? Because they're going to suffer. There's going to be situations coming at you as a leader that, you know, it's going to make you so angry, it's going to make you so disheartened. And the question is, can you hang in there even in spite of that? He must also have a good reputation with outsiders so that he will not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap. Yeah, so this is not falling into the sin of the devil, but the trap of the devil. A good reputation with outsiders. I mean, I guess if you didn't have that, then you'd be vulnerable to accusation from people outside the church. And that would look pretty bad that would reflect badly on the whole community if our leaders are looking bad. Part of what this is getting at is a non-compartmentalized life. You know, it's like some of us, it's like we got one persona when we're with our church friends, our home church, and then we've got a totally different persona when we're not. It's like two different personalities. And Paul says we can't have that. We got to have somebody with integrity, somebody who's the same person no matter where they are and who has a good reputation with people outside the church. You know, what do non-Christians think of this person? What do coworkers think of this person? What does their family think of this person? What does their neighbor think of this person? Now, granted, like we said last week, you can't please everybody. Even Jesus got critiques from his family, from his neighbors. But hopefully the consensus is pretty positive. Hopefully when people are like, man, I heard this bad thing about Zenos, the other person's like, I don't know. I got a coworker who goes there, and he's awesome. You know, he's like the nicest guy that I know. You know, so that's partly how we answer slander. is hopefully with the reputation, the testimony of our reputation. In the same way, then, he says deacons. And so he moves over into this other leadership position that's below eldership. Elders are above deacons, but deacon is still a real important leadership position in the church, like we saw last week. He says deacons, and a lot of these deacon traits we've already seen in the elder list. Worthy of respect, saw that one. Sincere, that's a new one. Sincere, literally not double-tongued, not a liar, not talking out of both sides of your mouth. And so this person is honest and upright. Not spitting the truth to make me look good. I tell the whole story, even the bad parts. And it's okay if people see the real me. I speak the truth in love. Yeah. I don't see something and then just refuse to say anything because, well, whatever, I'll just complain to this other person about them. They confess sin as well. They speak truth. They don't say one thing in one situation and one thing in another situation. So sincerity. He also says not indulging in much wine. We've seen that one already. Not pursuing dishonest gain. We saw that one about the money. Keeping hold of the deep truths of the faith with a clear conscience. That's a little bit new. These guys need to live out their faith, unlike the false teachers. Remember, they had a seared conscience. He said, these guys have a clear conscience. And so not only do they know their word, they know the scriptures, but also they hold on to that and they live it out. People who genuinely and sincerely live out their faith. And they can stand with a clear conscience before people and before God and say, yeah, I basically lived this out. They must first be tested, and then if there's nothing against them, let them serve as deacons. We mentioned that already. And then he says in the same way, the women are to be worthy of respect, not malicious talkers, but temperate and trustworthy in everything. Well, there's a little bit of debate. Some translations say deacons' wives. And this would be in the women are not allowed to lead camp. That would be an appealing interpretation there. It literally just says the women. I think deaconesses is a much better way to take this. It should be deaconesses. Seems like he's kind of adding in something a little special for the female deacons here based on maybe some of the problems they were having there at Ephesus. You know, if it's deacons' wives, then why didn't he say anything about elders' wives? You know, isn't elder like a higher standard than deacon? And so, you know, and he goes right back to talking about deacons after this verse as well. So I think deaconesses, and he's kind of highlighting a few things. Most of these have been mentioned already here. But this last one is really the last one in this section we haven't mentioned. He says they need to be trustworthy in everything. And I think that's kind of a good blanket statement that describes a lot of the other things on this list. Trustworthy or faithful in all things. That's what a leader needs to be. And that's why Paul says in 1 Corinthians 4, this then is how you ought to regard us, leaders. Servants of Christ and those who have been entrusted with the mysteries of God. And now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. Yeah, leaders are basically just people. You know, God has some really valuable stuff here on earth. He has Christian community. He has the message of his Son and the forgiveness that he offers. People's lives, people's spiritual lives. There's nothing more valuable to God than that. And he's got this truth, and he's got these people, and he says, I need somebody who I can trust that's going to love these people, that's going to teach these people, and it's going to try to help them to do that for other people as well. And so as leaders, you know, we're nothing special. We're servants, literally slaves. We're slaves of God. And we've been entrusted with something. And he says, what's the main thing required when somebody entrusts you with something is that you're faithful with what you've been entrusted with. And that's his description for leaders here and deacons, and really a description that applies to the whole list. All right, just a few final thoughts on leadership and on this list right here. Jesus himself said, as he looked out on this needy, confused, spiritually confused crowd of people, he said to his disciples, with compassion, he said, truly, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. You know, imagine a field just filled with apple trees, and the apples have to be harvested, but nobody's there, and the apples are falling off the trees. We need somebody to move in there and to gather the harvest. He says, the harvest is so plentiful, and the workers are so few. There's so much need out there in this world. People need Christ. And when God says he's looking for workers, I'll tell you who he's not looking for. He's not looking for the most popular. He's not looking for the most good-looking. He's not looking for the most charismatic, the wealthiest, the most gifted, the people who are high and mighty in the eyes of the world. That's not the kind of person that he's looking for, if that's all they are. I mean, he'll take those people. But what God is really looking for is he's looking for leaders he can trust. People who will put him first and people who will put others first. It's not a, there's no giftedness requirement for leaders. There's a trustworthiness requirement, though. There's a requirement that you have faith in God, that you trust him, that you're growing closer to him, that you're growing to be more like him. He's looking for people who will follow the central command to love God and to love one another. And frankly, we need leaders. In this ministry right here, you know, this is a ministry that has grown from like less than a couple hundred people 15 years ago to a couple to 2,000 people today. That is a staggering rate of growth. And with rapid growth, that can produce problems. And the biggest thing that we need to keep this going and also to keep this spiritual is we need spiritual leaders. And so the question for you is, will you answer God's call? Will you answer the call of Christ? Will you answer the prayers of Christ? That the Lord of the harvest would send more workers into the harvest. Maybe you're an answer to a lot of other people's prayers, that God would send more workers for the harvest. I want you to really think about that. All right, so we've got this free book then, as usual, for first-time guests, and a free drink, as usual. Man, we're so generous here. Free books, free drinks.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.